Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York. We welcome you. You can watch today's show by going to ustream.tv and search for Gary Null. The latest on health and healing. Pomegranate and chamomile can help a condition suffered by tens of millions. Industrial chemicals are causing a global neurodevelopmental epidemic, and this is just at a time when there's a new bill that's being passed around Congress that you have not yet heard about, but this is part of our call to action. I'm going to inform you about the bill and why it's bad to the bone, and if this gets passed, then every chemical imaginable could be marketed with no requirement for safety studies. I'll tell you about that. Millions of people, young women and young men, take Gardasil vaccine with the idea that it will prevent cervical cancer. There's no proof of that at all. To the contrary, we have seen over 130 deaths attributable to Gardasil vaccine by their parents. We have seen tens of thousands injured, and yet, because of the power of the pharmaceutical industry, its control over the FDA and CDC, the National Institutes of Health, there is virtually total approval of its being used on a massive scale. We will and have shown that it is ineffective and dangerous. Those articles, fully documented, full scholarship articles, are on my website. You should use them and read them. There's over 28 of them, representing the largest single group of articles that challenge the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Now there's new research out today that I'll tell you about where a simple supplement can help eradicate the human papillomavirus, a Japanese mushroom extract, active hextose, correlated compound, which is called AHCC, has a role in preventing human papilloma-related cancers. So something natural, non-toxic, inexpensive is what works. The vaccine does not and is dangerous. But today I'm also going to play an interview with a woman, a medical doctor, board certified, on the safety and efficacy question of vaccines. Then, in our environmental segment today, we're going to look at the latest on climate change and the deniers. According to one report, and this is an important one because it's the largest group of scientists who are environmental scientists, we are way past the point where we can do anything that's going to be meaningful. And then that leads to another commentary by Nick Cohen. The climate change deniers have won. Scientists continue to warn us about global warming, but most of us have a vested interest in not wanting to think about it. And then I saw a video that was very disturbing, and I believe it is now posted. I'll let you know if it is, and you can watch it. It's a short video. It was taken by a police camcorder on top of his helmet, showing a person who had been out hiking and camping, and they approached him, and they said he was camping in the wrong place, and he said, all right, so he gets up to leave and puts on his backpack, and as he's coming down the hill, they just shoot and kill him. That's it. Shot and killed a completely innocent person. They'll get away with it. Police seem to always get away with this. I'm very concerned about the militarization of police. I'm concerned about the nature of disconnecting from any moral imperative when you shoot someone. I remember it's typical of Brooklyn police, but this is really egregious when a naked man on top of a roof who was clearly involved in some psychotic episode is shot and killed. Why do you have to kill a person? If he's naked, there are other ways of getting a man who represents no threat to a whole group of police. And of course, the police always get away with it. Always. This is disturbing. It should disturb you. You watch this film, you'll understand why I'm concerned. So today, from David Lindorf, crime's down, so why is police aggression increasing? I'll give that commentary. Also, I spent the better part of the weekend writing commentaries and preparing commentaries for this week. Today, I will begin Beyond Neoliberal Miseducation. I believe that what is happening to our educational system is extremely concerning, so I'll be sharing the thoughts and words of Professor Henry Giroux from Truthout and myself. Let's begin. We have a lot to cover. Researchers from Brazil's State University have determined that extracts from pomegranate and chamomile can help heal bleeding gums. Millions of Americans have bleeding gums. First, because they have poor circulation. Secondly, because they have infections, local infections and gingivitis and periodontal conditions, receding of the gum lines, poor diet, lots of carbonated beverages, all that allows a very weak medium around the gums. And most people are not aware, but if they took samples, saliva samples, the food, when they're chewing, when you chew a food mechanically, you create what is called bolus. It's a insalivated mashup of your food. If you were to look at that under a microscope, many people would be shocked to see there's blood in it. Almost imperceptible, but that's from the gums. And the researchers tested a group of patients who had bleeding gums and gingivitis. They were split into three groups, and each rinsed twice a day with an assigned rinse for 15 days. One rinsed with chamomile extract, another rinsed with pomegranate extract, and a third rinsed with a non-affective agent. And what they found was that pomegranate and chamomile had antimicrobial effects, and they reduced the pathogenic oral bacteria significantly. That included killing Staphylococcus mitis and Staphylococcus sangus, which are known to accumulate as biofilm and excrete toxins that produce inflammation, pain, and bleeding. And these same toxins can also leak into the bloodstream and can damage your blood vessels and tissues and organs. Now, we know that chamomile contains several flavonoids and what are called terpenoids, and which have been shown to have antibacterial and anti-inflammatory effects. Pomegranate is also antimicrobial, but it's also a very powerful stimulant to the immune system. It's very alkaloid. If you want to alkalize your diet, the tannins in pomegranate can help do that. So think of it this way. You really should take a look at your teeth. If you have bad breath, the breath may be due to the fact that you have bleeding gums and there is pus underneath the gums that you can't see. But if a dentist pushed in on the gum, a little bit of the leukocytes would come out, the little white pus. And that always has a terrible smell to it. Now, that's only one cause of bad breath. That's even when a person brushes, and that's what confuses people. I shouldn't have bad breath. I brushed and I flossed. Yes. And did you clean your tongue with a tongue cleaner? Now, if you still have bad breath, do you have candida? And that can come back up through the intestines, through the stomach, right up through the mouth. Do you have oral cavity inflammation? Are your sinus cavities inflamed? If you're allergic to dairy, it's very common to have inflammation in your cavities around your nose. Those drip into the back of the throat. So when you exhale air, you inhale, you exhale. As you exhale, the air acts like a fan, blowing the bad bacteria smelling air into the environment. Hence, you can say, but I shouldn't have bad breath. I brush, yes. But you could have bleeding gums. That can lead to bad breath. Parasites, candida, that can lead to bad breath. You can have bacteria in your sinuses, frequently from allergies or a depressed immune system. Detoxification can clean all that up. We really shouldn't have bad breath. Now, industrial chemicals are a big issue. And they're a big issue for no other reason than we have never given them the attention they deserve. I lived in Wheeling, West Virginia after college. I lived in Kittanning, Pennsylvania, after college. Weirton, West Virginia, right across from Steubenville. And I grew up in Parkersburg, which is in the Kanawha Valley, just about 10, 15 miles from DuPont. And the whole river, the Ohio River and the Kanawha River, loaded with chemical factories. It was very common for people to be coughing and hacking all the time. And we simply adapted to it because we didn't know how bad it was. Then I had friends who also had brown lung, black lung, and you knew it was from the mines, but you accepted it because what are you going to do? You can't change the mines, you thought. Of course, we did in time, but not enough. So I've been around this. I even remember once coming out, and I saw it starting to snow out my window. Oh, that's really cool. So I went downstairs and went outside, and within a half hour of it snowing, it all looked like someone took a spray gun with red paint and sprayed it in the air and let these droplets of red come down on the snow. All the snow had these tiny little red specks. That was the particulate matter from the smokestacks. Now, I had invented, when I was in high school, in fact, I'd invented a form of a catalytic cleanser that would go inside of smokestacks. And I sent over my drawings. I was an inventor. I had about 150 inventions. And the automatic fabric cutting, the automatic fish feeder, the cybernated coating for mail delivery, way before the zip code system, a repixelization of dead movie stars to make a new movie. Yeah, I have all that written. When I was 13 years old, I did that. And, of course, I didn't have any that succeed, but one of them was how you clean particulate matter out of a smokestack. And interesting, the head of a man named Dr. Carson, head of Pittsburgh Steel, invited me in, so I met with a whole group of scientists about how this would work, and they agreed. There was nothing in the drawings that showed in my plans that would not be able to clean up the air. Never got any calls after that. I don't know if anything ever happened. I was very naive about everything. But I knew that it wasn't good. I knew that all this stuff on the ground and in our air and in our hair, and you couldn't walk outside without getting it on your body. But people adapted to it. They just adapted. And that's what we've done all over the world. We adapt. This is the latest from Medical News Today, published in The Lancet, Journal Neurology. Quote, a new review published in The Lancet Neurology stresses the importance of a global overhaul of regulations regarding industrial chemicals, as experts warn that child exposure to such toxins could cause, quote, a silent epidemic of brain development disorders worldwide. According to Dr. Grandjean of Harvard School of Public Health, and Dr. Langdrian of Mount Sinai School of Medicine, New York, the number of chemicals that are recognized to be linked to neurodevelopmental disorders has increased from 6 to 12. Lead, methylmercury, arsenic, polychlorinated biphenyls, toluene were the only chemicals linked to brain development disorders. But last year, fluoride and a pesticide and DDT and a solvent and a polybromylated diphenyl ethers, flame retardant, were added to the list. Furthermore, the experts note that the number of chemicals that have been associated with human brain damage but have not been regulated to protect children's health has increased to 214 last year. So what they're saying is this, in lay language, they're saying that there's 80,000 industrial chemicals in wide use today in the United States. They have never been tested for their toxic effects on the developing fetus or child. And they're not going to. But now when we do test, there's an association in so many of these. So that's why we should be concerned about where we live, the cleanliness of the environment, the air, the water. Because when we consume that water, if it's contaminated, we become that contamination. When 72% of your body is water, you should be very concerned about the cleanliness of the water. Now, this is today from the Environmental Working Group. Thousands of untested chemicals could be labeled as safe with no testing. And that's because the Chemicals in Commerce Act is being shopped around the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, it's beyond the pale. This bill, backed by chemical industry lobbyists, is more than a rubber stamp for untested chemicals. If passed, this bill would not require companies to prove chemicals safe before they hit the market. It would allow thousands, tens of thousands of chemicals to be considered safe with little or no investigation. Your representative needs to hear from you. We need toxic reform that protects us, not big chemical companies. Now, you should reach out to the Environmental Working Group and then go to a call to action, because they're leading the charge on this, and I'm going to get our audience involved. Again, we want to say no to the Chemicals in Commerce Act. The Chemicals in Commerce Act. Let your House representative know we do not want this. Just simply, it would leave children and consumers unprotected. It creates no deadlines for chemical safety reviews. So you could have a toxic chemical like DDT today out there for a dozen years, 20 years, and nothing would happen to it. It blocks states from acting independently to protect their own residents. It limits with intent the Environmental Protection Agency's power to consider sound science when investigating chemicals. And it fails to consider threats to children and the elderly when setting priorities for investigating questionable or new chemicals. So we need a groundswell of opposition before this can gain traction in Congress. Normally we don't find out about something while it's still being shopped around. Now we know it. Let's go after it and let's stop it. The Chemicals and Commerce Act is a bad to the bone act. Let us fight it. Also, from the environmental segment today, Australia's 2013 summer was the hottest on record. Why? According to the climate change experts there, because of human activity. They said that it's no doubt that it was human activity. In fact, the country's Bureau of Meteorology is a model of clarity. Quote, 2013 was Australia's warmest year on record. Persistent and widespread warmth throughout the year led to record-breaking temperatures and several severe brush fires. Nationally, average rainfall was slightly below average. Now, Australian scientists say it is virtually certain that no records would have been broken had it not been for the influence on the climate by humans. They've even put a finger on it. People then say, well, you know, are we responsible? You bet you are. But are people doing anything about it? You bet they are not. So the overwhelming consensus worldwide of the experts in the field say climate change is real and humans are responsible, but they're not going to do anything about it. Now I'll go to why in a moment, but I also want to add with our environmental segment that fossil fuel giants are guzzling the world's water as poor go thirsty. This is in the UN. An unrelenting increase in energy production, including unconventional methods such as tar sands extraction and hydrofracking, will severely damage the world's already dwindling water supply. Now, the UN just gave this report on Friday. Quote, there is an increasing potential for serious conflict between power generation, other water users, and environmental considerations. That's according to the UN's World Water Development Report, Water and Energy, published on the eve of World Water Day. The energy sector, which has, quote, great political clout, meaning those who have the money, the utility companies, can dictate policy. And we have seen a big increase in the need for water, and it's going to increase even more. But right now, a billion people don't have adequate water, and a lot of those people are now in the United States. If you remember, about 5 years ago, I outlined on a one-hour special on water that there were 16 states that are running out of water. Now it's 20 states that are running out of water. And why most people will do nothing about it? Because the major concentrations of people in Los Angeles, in Phoenix, in Las Vegas, in Atlanta, in Orlando, these individuals are not immediately impacted as would be a person living in the country. On my trip through America, and I've driven through Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, California, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi. I'm able to see what's going on. I'm able to speak with hundreds of people. I film so many. And when you see, for example, a farmer whose fields are fallow because he doesn't have the water. And so I say, what are you going to do? And he said, well, he said, the property has dropped in value by about 70% because there's no water. No one's going to buy a priest's property that doesn't have any way of irrigating, either vegetables or for animals. He said, we don't know what to do. I'm hearing that everywhere. But if you were sitting in a restaurant on Rodeo Drive, everything in the world you could want is right in front of you. For the very wealthy and the super wealthy and the hyper wealthy, they will always have all the resources that they want and the safety to enjoy them. But it's when you get out of that circle, what I call the green circle, that you then have to see how tough things are. This is from Joe Rahm, Climate Progress. Quote, climate scientists, quote, we're alarmed. Here's why you should be too. This week, the world's largest general scientific society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, has issued an uncharacteristically blunt call to action on climate change. The must-read news report by the association, quote, what we know, has several simple messages. Here are some of those messages. Climate scientists agree climate change is happening here and now. Based upon well-established evidence, 97% of all the climate scientists in the world have concluded that human-caused climate change is happening. 97%. The other 3% show up on Hannity's show on Fox Network. The scientists linking human activities to climate change is analogous to the science linking smoking to lung and cardiovascular disease. Physicians, cardiovascular scientists, public health experts, and others all agree smoking causes cancer. And this consensus among the health community has convinced most Americans that the health risks from smoking are real. A similar consensus now exists among climate scientists, a consensus that maintains climate change is happening and human activity is the cause. Average global temperatures has increased 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 100 years. Sea levels are rising, and some types of extreme events, such as heat waves, heavy rain, are happening more frequently. Recent scientific findings indicate that climate change is likely responsible for the increase in the intensity of these events. Hence, the next time you hear one of the people say, well, it's the coldest day imaginable, couldn't be from climate change, couldn't be from global warming. Yes, it is. In fact, the mudslides that have killed dozens of people in California in one community, or not in California, in near Seattle, in the state of Washington, that's from climate change. Too much rain, and it causes the ground to give way. We are at risk, quote, of pushing our climate system towards abrupt, unpredictable, and potentially irreversible changes with highly damaging impacts. We can think of this as sudden climate break and steering failure, where the problem and its consequences are no longer something we can control. Just imagine being in a car going 60 miles an hour, and suddenly your steering wheel doesn't work, your brakes don't work. What are you going to do? So this is what's going on out there, and it's happening worldwide, but it's really absolutely, quote, areas such as the U.S. Southwest are witnessing more drought, and these two are consistent with global change patterns projected by climate models as a consequence of rising CO2. The global area hit by extremely hot summertime temperatures has increased 50-fold, and fingerprint of global warming has been firmly identified in these trends. Hence, when I'm explaining that wildfires, earthquakes, tornadoes, drought, 20 states now I wouldn't move to because of that. And finally, beta-glucans can boost natural killer cells to fight cancer and boost immunity. This is good news because we all have killer cells. They're called natural killer cells. And they go through the body and they'll grab onto a cancer cell and kill it. But how do you stimulate that to prevent cancer, and if you have cancer, to help your body keep that cancer from spreading? Well, now we know that the cells, walls of mushrooms, and algae, and lichens, and plants are all rich in polysaccharides, and that is what makes beta-glucan so important. Quote, they are effector lymphocyte of the innate immune system that controls several types of tumors and microbial infections by limiting their spread and subsequent tissue damage. Recent research highlights the fact that natural killer cells are also regulatory cells engaged in reciprocal interactions with dendritic cells, macrophages, T cells, and endothelial cells, end quote. So, in lay language, if you want the body to be able to fight to prevent cancer or fight if you have cancer, you want to increase the white blood cells, the natural killer cells in the white blood cell, what are called lymphocytes, that seek out and kill cancerous tissue. Eat your mushrooms. The shiitake mushroom has really strong anti-cancer activities. Very high levels of beta-glucans in the shiitake mushrooms. Seaweeds also are important in that respect and will help you. Now, here is a short commentary from Nick Cohen from The Observer. This ties in to why is it, if we know that we are tipping, if we know that there are places we should not move to, we're running out of resources, and yet we're all living as if there were three planet Earths to extract resources from. Why? Quote, the American Association for the Advancement of Science came as close as such a respected institution can to screaming an alarm last week. Quote, as scientists, it is our role to tell people what they should do. But human-caused climate risks abrupt, unpredictable, and potentially irreversible changes. In other words, the most distinguished scientists from the country with the world's preeminent educational institutions are trying to shake humanity out of its complacency. Why weren't there warning leading up to this news? In one sense, the association's appeal was not new. The Royal Society, the Royal Institution, NASA, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, the U.S. Geological Survey, the IPCC, and the national science bodies of 30 or so other countries have said that man-made climate change is on the march. A survey of 2,000 peer-reviewed scientific papers on global warming published in the last 20 years found 97% of them humans were causing it. When the glib talk about the scientific debate on global warming, they either don't know or will not accept that there is no scientific debate. The suggestion first made by Eugene Stromer that the planet has moved from the Holocene, which began at the end of the last ice age, to the man-made Anthropocene, in which we now live, is everywhere gaining support. Man-made global warming and the man-made mass extinction of species define this hot and epic in world history. So if global warming is not new, it is urgent, a subject that should never be far from our thoughts. Yet within 24 hours of the American Association's warning, the British government's budget confirmed that it no longer wanted to fight it. David Cameron, who once promised that if you voted blue, you would go green, now appoints Owen Paterson, a man who is not just ignorant of environmental science, but proud of his ignorance, as his environmental secretary. George Osborne, who once promised that his treasury would be, quote, at the heart of the historic fight against climate change, now gives billions in tax concessions to the oil and gas industry, cuts the funds for onshore wind farms, and strips the Green Investment Bank of the ability to borrow and lend. All of which is a long way of saying that the global warming deniers have won, and the evidence for man-made global warming is as final as the evidence of Auschwitz. No other word will do. Tempting though it is to blame cowardly politicians, the abuse comes too easily. The question remains, what turned them into cowards? Right-wing billionaires in the United States and the oil companies have spent fortunes on blocking action on climate change. A part of the answer may therefore be the conservative politicians in Washington, in Canberra, in London, are going along what they do. You know, they're buying support. There's truth in bribery hypothesis, and we've seen it everywhere. But the right is also going along with an eruption of know-nothing populism, just as there are leftist greens who will never accept that genetically modified foods are safe, so an ever-growing element on the right becomes more militant on the temperature rises. And then it goes on to talk about how we're just in denial. My own thoughts on that are that once we become comfortable with what's in our life, ask that person then to change to a discomforting position, and more often than not, they'll say no. If we know we should be getting solar energy, if we know we should be decorating the outside of our houses with vines like Irish ivy, which can keep the temperature inside warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer, we won't do it. If we know that we should be buying organic, we still won't do it. The majority of people won't. The majority of the people are gluttonous. They will do what they want to do when they want to do it without any thought of the likely consequences to themselves, society, or the world. And yet they're the ones who are keeping the population in effect in a stagnant position because they're the ones voting for the politicians who are in the pocket of industry, or they're the ones listening to the popular talk show hosts who tell you that global warming doesn't exist. And that's unfortunate. It doesn't mean that we can't do a lot. We still are. It just means we have to be realistic what we're up against. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to come back in a moment. Commentary. And then I'm going to share some inside thoughts with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on the safety of vaccines, efficacy and safety issues coming up. That's what should be at the heart of the debate. After all, if someone said you should vaccinate your kid, you should give them these dozens of vaccines, shouldn't someone say, what's your proof they're safe and effective? We're not even asking the basic questions. We will in a moment. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm going to set some time aside near the end of our program for Talk Back, and you'll have a chance to call in and share your points of view. I'm going to take the issue of NATO for our discussion this evening, an entire hour on the North American Treaty Alliance and why it's a bad thing, and it's at the heart of many of our conflicts in the world today, and it's not being criticized. It should be, and why we don't need it should be disbanded completely. That's on our Progressive Commentary Hour, 7 p.m. My efforts to put together a dance party, well, we over-succeeded. We've had thousands of people call in and want to come to the free dance party to celebrate the end of our marathon on WBAI fundraiser. Thank goodness we're past that. So what I'm doing is I'm going to go down there later today and see if I saw when I went down to look at the space, which is nice and on the Upper West Side. There was a room, I believe it's a VIP section, and that wasn't to be included in this. I'm going to go see if we can open up, because right now we're full. There's no more room to come and dance with us. So please don't call until I try to find us some more room. Okay, but it's certainly going to be a packed evening for those who come. Commentary, and then some thoughts from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. It's a short piece that all of us could benefit from. I'm very concerned about what I see happening and the wrong arguments that are being issued when it comes to our educational system. As universities turn towards corporate management models, and that's what they're doing, they're increasingly using and exploiting cheap faculty labor while expanding the ranks of their managerial class. Modeled after a savage neoliberal value system in which wealth and power are redistributed upwards, a market-oriented class of managers largely has taken over the growing structures of most institutions of higher education in the United States. As Deborah Lee Scott points out, administrators now outnumber faculty on every campus across the country. there is more at stake here than metrics. Benjamin Ginsberg views this shift in governance as the rise of what he calls, ominously, the all-administrative university, noting that it does not bode well for any notion of higher education as a democratic public sphere. And that's simply a reality. A little or no administrative support is going on. A number of colleges and universities are drawing more and more adjunct and non-tenured faculty, whose ranks now constitute about 1 million out of 1.5 million faculty, many of whom occupy the status of indentured servants, who are overworked, lack benefits, receive little or no administrative support, and are paid salaries that increasingly qualify them for food stamps. Many students increasingly fare no better in sharing the status of a lower class beholden to neoliberal policies and values, and largely treated as consumers for whom education has become little more than a service. Too many students are buried under the huge debts that have become a major source of celebration by the collection industry, because it allows them to cash in on the misfortune and hardships of an army of indebted students. Under the regime of neoliberal education, including especially this president and the Clintons, misery breeds a combination of contempt and source of profits for the banks and other financial industries. Jerry Aston, a member of the industry, wrote a column after witnessing a protest rally by students criticizing their mounting debt that he, quote, couldn't believe the accumulated wealth they represent for our industry. And of course, this type of economic injustice is taking place in an economy in which rich plutocrats, such as the infamous union-busting Koch brothers, saw each, quote, their investments grow by $6 billion in 1 year, which amounts to the $3 million per hour based on a 40-hour work week. One astonishing figure of greed and concentrated power is revealed in the fact that in 2012, the Koch brothers, quote, made enough money in 1 second, 1 second, to feed one homeless woman for an entire year. Workers, students, youth, and the poor are all considered expendable with this neoliberal global economy. And yet the one institution, education, that offers the opportunities for students to challenge these anti-democratic tendencies is under attack in ways that are unparalleled, at least in terms of the scope and intensity of the assault by the corporate elite and other economic fundamentalists. You've heard it before on this program. It's called casino capitalism. It does more than infuse market values into every aspect of higher education. It also wages a full-fledged assault on public goods, democratic public spheres, and the role of education in creating an informed and enlightened citizenry. When former presidential candidate Senator Rick Santorum argued that intellectuals were not wanted in the Republican Party, he was articulating what has become common sense in a society wedded to narrow instrumentalist values, ignorance as a political tool, and a deep-seated fear of civil literacy, and a broad-based endorsement of the commons. Critical thinking and a literate public have become dangerous to those who want to celebrate orthodoxy over dialogue, emotion over reason, and ideological certainty over thoughtfulness. Hannah Arendt, warning that it was not stupidity, but a ideological certainty over thoughtfulness, and the quiet, authentic inability to think at the heart of authoritarian regimes, is now embraced as a fundamental tenet of right-wing politicians and pundits, increasingly has become a matter of common sense for the entertainment industry and the dominant media, all primary modes of an education industry that produces consumers, smothers the country in an empty fog of celebrity culture, and denounces democracy as tantamount to the enemy of free market fundamentalism. How else to explain the willingness of so many people today to give up every vestige of privacy to the social media, the government, and anyone else interested in collecting data for the most despicable anti-democratic purposes? Self-interest does more than embrace a new culture of narcissism. It empties out any viable notion of the social compassion and ethical imagination. Right-wing and corporate left-wing, they are bedded, they are wedded, they are homogenized, commodified together. Whether it's the Clinton corporate Democrats or it's the rich, mindless Republicans. They provide the idea that austerity is a rationale that should be accepted for slashing and burning policies intended to deprive government finance, social and educational programs of the funds needed to enable them to work, if not survive. Along with health care, public transportation, Medicare, food stamp programs for low-income children, and a host of other social protections, higher education is being defunded as part of a larger scheme to dismantle and privatize all public services and goods and spheres. The passion for public values has given way to the ruthless quest for profits and the elevation of self-interest over the common good. The educational goal of expanding the capacity of critical thought and of outer limits of the imagination have given way to the instrumental desert of a mind-deafening audit culture. But there is more at work here than the march towards privatization and the never-ending search for profits at any cost. There's also the issue of wasteful spending on a bloated war machine, the refusal to tax fairly the rich and corporations, the draining of public funds for the U.S. military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the ongoing consolidation of class power in the hands of the upper 1%. I will continue with part two on tomorrow's program. And by the way, just to show you how prescient that is, this is from Becky Tush from Salon. Quote, professors in homeless shelters. It's time to talk about, seriously, about adjuncts. And it goes on to say, we've known each other for a long while. We first met in 2009. Goes on to talk about what it means to be an adjunct professor and how they're teaching 70% of college courses and what they're paid, how they're treated. And now one of them's in a homeless shelter that I'm filming this week. And we have a lot of them now who are homeless and struggling. This is Humphreys, Dr. Humphreys, on the safety and efficacy question of vaccines.
I have been studying vaccines for the past 3 years of my life when it came up in my professional life. And my current opinion about vaccinations is that they have never been safe. Never has there been a safe vaccine. Never will there be a safe vaccine. And it is not possible to have a safe vaccine. The reasoning for that is that the actual process of vaccination defies the natural function of the immune system of living beings. It thwarts the immune system into a balance that's very unnatural and that leaves it susceptible to more things than just what you've maybe vaccinated supposedly for. Putting a disease matter into a body and thinking that the manner of which it's going in, i.e. usually through a muscle, through the skin, using a very unnatural thing, a needle, combined with all the chemicals and antibiotics and things that the manufacturing companies may not even know about at the time that they're being injected into a muscle, there's no possible way that that can be safe. Now, when you're bypassing the normal immune system by putting this disease matter into a muscle, you are stimulating yet another abnormal response at the site of the injection, pooling of all sorts of metals and things that call in the immune cells in this very unnatural way. And the result that these manufacturers or designers of vaccines often look for is simply an antibody, which is one small thing in the cascade of immunity that is so incredibly elegant they probably cannot appreciate. Obviously don't appreciate if calling a simple antibody, which is highly unpredictable, immunity is insanity. If indeed it is such a miraculous product, wouldn't we be noticing how miraculous it is? Are they saying that we are just too stupid to notice that this is killing people and maiming people, that we're too stupid to notice that it's miraculous? You know, I think that is a lot of the argument. We're just too stupid to notice how miraculous this is. So to protect everybody, they're going to give it to us anyway. Why must such a wonderful product be forced upon people since the beginning of vaccination? If people were really seeing each other dropping dead of smallpox and they were really seeing each other being saved by a smallpox vaccine, the line would be out of town, you know, to get it. That's never been the case. The history books really show that the people that were vaccinated were among the sickest, that many children were dying after smallpox vaccinations. that they were developing terrible ulcerations. Beautiful, perfect babies, you know, forced into smallpox vaccines, either dying or developing terrible, terrible diseases. And the diseases are often said, oh, that would have happened anyway. But parents who watch this happen time and again know otherwise. So those of us who actually notice the science is not backing up vaccination, those of us who notice that people are being maimed and killed by vaccinations, those of us who have experienced our own vaccine reactions are categorically thought to be mad, despite the fact that we've actually studied it. You know, none of my colleagues in the past studied vaccines, yet they still would think that the sound bites that they heard over and over and over the years about vaccines being safe and effective trumped any book knowledge that I may have attained and tried to discuss with them. It's baffling. It's like the minds have been sucked into this paradigm so deeply, and it's not just the minds of these doctors, but it's the safety net, and it's the comfort zone, and it's the rewards that they're getting as a result of all they're doing. And the rewards are not watching people get healthy. The rewards are monetary and the rewards are power. That's it. It's money and it's power. Many of the vaccine enthusiast doctors will parrot the phrase that babies need to be vaccinated when they're young because the take rate is better for the vaccine. Parents are being told to bring their 2-month, 4-month, 6-month-old infants in to have them injected with some 24 different disease matter injections, complete with the polysorbate 80, amounts of aluminum that are absolutely unsafe with the amount of body weight they're being injected into, which, by the way, is to generate the immune response that's desired. That's what the aluminum is there for. They're being told to bring these children in, and the real reason is because they need to get them there at 1 year. They need to train the parents. So to train the parents, they're injecting these children. I mean, how sick is this? If it's only to train the parents, then why not just give them a saline injection at 2, 4, and 6 months, and let's just keep it to ourselves? Why do we have to inject disease matter that won't be effective and that will be problematic at 2, 4, and 6 months? An infant's immune system develops slowly. That's normal. It's part of the design. There are certain interleukins and TNFs, which are other kinds of immune cell secreted chemicals that fire up our immune system, that are specifically by nature blunted in a newborn. Vaccine scientists have been working on developing a way to rev those chemicals up because they think nature is flawed, because they think Mother Nature got it all wrong when designing the immune system of an infant, that Mother Nature had no idea how to create a human being that could fight off its own diseases while it was an infant and as it was growing. These immune chemicals that are not secreted at high levels for an infant are done so purposefully so that the immune system can develop slowly and, I'll say, thoughtfully, because the immune system does have a mind of its own. So it has to be able to respond correctly, react correctly, give feedback correctly. It is essentially like a mind in that sense. So why aren't these children all dying? Why are they not extremely vulnerable to disease, more so than the vaccine enthusiasts actually say they are? Is because of breast milk. It's because of breast milk from a healthy mother who's eating a good diet. This is the design. You know, the design is to have these chemicals at a low level in an immature infant being supplemented by mother's milk. That's it. It's worked for a really long time. It works very well. And what that produces is an immune system that is highly competent in later years. And it puts forward an immune system that is still competent, even in a world full of bacteria, encapsulated bacteria that would require these responses in us, because the mother is able to essentially protect the baby with antibody through breast milk. So the inventors of vaccines have chosen a belief system whereby infants are all born with inadequate immune systems. and that the only way they can be saved from hepatitis B, rotavirus, et cetera, the infant vaccines, that the only way they can be saved from these diseases is getting vaccines into them as quickly as possible in multiple injections. So why do we need multiple injections? Well, they need multiple injections basically because these vaccines don't cause the immune response after one injection that would ultimately be desired by vaccine designers. Or maybe not, because each vaccine actually has its own charge that goes with it, the amount of money that it's worth and that is charged for the administration. So the more vaccines given, the more money generated. But also, the fact of the matter is that these young babies have a blunted immune response compared to you or I. And that's one of the reasons why the aluminum is added to the vaccines, is to stimulate that immune response by pooling aluminum into the muscle and calling forth immune cells to react to it, which is an absolutely unnatural thing. So what happens when babies are given a vaccine is that this normal non-reactivity of the immune system is abolished. And the non-reactivity then becomes hyper-reactivity, and that's why we're seeing so much asthma, so much reactive airway disease, allergies to peanuts and so on and so forth, latex. It's because of these injections that these young children are getting, not only that have the disease matter in them, but that have provoked the immune system in an unnatural way, shifting the normal balance of non-reactivity into one of hyper-reactivity. I think the reason that many people don't trust their own immune systems is because they've been conditioned to not trust it. They've never been given the opportunity to actually get sick and recover without an allopathic intervention. And because when they do get sick, they're given acetaminophen, ibuprofen, antibiotics, antivirals. And guess what? When you put those things into somebody who's sick, you'll make them sicker. But the person that's sick may think that the illness that they had just got worse. They're not going to think that the drugs that they took, I can't convince people that the drugs that they've taken made them sicker and that they wouldn't have just gotten sicker anyway. It's very difficult because of the belief systems people have in what's on the shelves in the stores and what's being advertised on television, helping them with the beautiful pictures and the healthy people that are used in these ads. And then you have a doctor standing there with a degree who's gone through all this training and education saying, your own immune system isn't enough to fight this. That's because the doctor doesn't know how to take care of an immune system, because the doctor was never taught in medical school how to take care of an immune system. So what you end up with is a whole society from start to finish that doesn't know how an immune system works, that doesn't know how to take care of it, doesn't know how to replenish the nutrients and minerals that are needed, does not know how to ingest a diet that will support it, and then when it fails, it's God's fault. We need a vaccine. You know, it just wasn't designed properly. Or, you know, these infections have gotten so much worse that our immune systems just can't fight them. I don't believe that's true. I don't believe that a healthy system that's detoxified and has a tuned immune system can't handle just about anything that comes along.
And that was Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Again, a voice of intelligence, a person who wanted to know the truth, look for it and found it. If only the other 99% of physicians were as curious and as open as she. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.